And I said, wow. I go, would you go work for that company again? And he's like, no way. And if you know anybody who's decent, don't let them go to work at that company. I said, wow. So if you're running a company right now, you don't want that to be you. And so let's get into our talk. There we go. So it's been rumored that you only hire the best and the brightest at your company, that your corporate culture rewards teamwork, innovation, entrepreneurship. That is until somebody quits. Then it's persona non grata. This strategy has worked fine until now. So what's changed? Everything. And the quid pro quo. Everybody in this room knows that the era of lifetime employment is over. 25% of all workers have only been with their company for less than a year. Think about that velocity that's happening inside the workforce. What talent needs is, in exchange for building your business, is challenge, yes, commensurate compensation, and above all else, an esprit de corps. They want to know why they're getting up and doing it every day for you. And guess what? The other thing that's happened is they actually have been building their own security blanket since the beginning of the internet. They know that, that everything about their careers is something that they're responsible for. And that includes mastering subject matter expertise, building connections, and clout. And that's clout with a C. And they're smarter than you think. Oops. Sorry. Went fast. Sorry. Oops. You'd think that I'd done this before. I've only done this 400 times. Okay, here we go. They want partnership, not ownership. And institutional apathy should be your greatest fear. Think this is crazy? Think again. Millennials are going to make up 50% of the workplace by 2020. And guess what? Baby boomers and Gen Xers feel the same way. This isn't just about the young population of workers coming on. People want to have a new kind of relationship with your company. They want it to extend, and they'll give you a new kind of loyalty. That's me. I started this event called the Pink Slip Parties back in 2000. And I started them because I launched my company, The Hired Guns, and about a month after that, the entire stock market collapsed, and that was the dot-com meltdown. And thousands of people started to get laid off. I knew many of them. We banded together, and we started this event called the Pink Slip Party, specifically to change the tenor of the conversation. It wasn't the workers' fault. It wasn't. And so we wanted to make a difference, and we really did. Now Pink Slip Parties happen all around the world, and Wall Street even has their own version. So it worked. So just like your customers, your employees and alumni now have a voice. Back in 2000, they didn't. Today, they do. And they'll use it. They're not afraid. And what you don't want if you're running company is a bunch of angry birds running around. You might be sitting there thinking, oh my God, I'm feeling like I'm losing control of my organization. And the answer is you haven't. You just have to trust in your people. Their power and potential is enormous. So don't waste it. Because predicting superstars is hard. And you never know who's going to end up on top, who's going to be your next client, and who's going to be your next boss. So even if you're sitting in the driver's seat as a head of a business, that guy sitting across from you who you're working on, mentoring, or ignoring could end up being your boss someday. So don't be evil. What you want to do is engineer a relationship-driven culture from the beginning. It starts way earlier than you think. At the Hired Guns, we place talent into great companies. And it's amazing to me how many companies screw up that first interview. It starts then. That's when the relationship begins. So you want to be able to manage that. I have individuals who refuse to ever go work for specific companies ever again based upon how they were treated in the interview process. And guess what? Those people are now sitting in the driver's seats as clients. So you want to think, as people evolve and improve, they're not always going to be kids or middle-level managers. They're also going to be running companies someday, and they're going to be on the other side of the negotiating table as your client. You also want to break silos and collaborate, and you want to do this early. You want to create relationships between your talent, not just between you and the talent, but between the talent, so that that becomes a formative experience in their career and so that it lasts, even when they're not inside the organization. One thing that you can absolutely do and should do is to establish a corporate alumni program. And you can do that when your company's small, mid-sized, or even large. What that means is that's building a program around your former employees, tapping into that, creating the framework for success. The most successful ones, actually, though, do a really interesting thing. They open that alumni network where they place jobs for the company, and they let alumni place jobs from their companies onto it. And then the most successful ones actually open it up to employees. And that's an amazing level of trust between employees and employers. Deloitte did that right at the time when they were starting to have layoffs inside their organization. And they said, we got so much love back from people who knew that they weren't going to be able to stay but wanted to have a relationship with us. And they appreciated the trust. So if you build an employee alumni network, you want to leverage it when employees are transitioning out. This is a very difficult subject. It's hard. Somebody is not happy inside an organization and somebody leaves, either the boss or the talent. But we're all grown-ups. We know that velocity is quick inside organizations, that you're not always going to be with someone, and that's key. So done right, all this work will pay off. You're probably wondering where the ROI is. And the ROI comes from four areas: positive branding and innovation, reducing recruiting costs, attracting the right referrals, and the big money ticket is new business development. I'll get into that in a second. What's interesting, and I think intellectually we all know this, is that the more closely alumni are connected, the better the returns. These two very interesting Harvard professors put together a white paper and found that they studied mutual fund managers and their clients. And what they found was when mutual fund managers and their clients went to the same college, they did more business together, not surprising there, but they actually got higher returns. Because of proximity, there is higher trust. So you can do better and bigger things with your clients when you know them. You want to turn your current and former employees into brand ambassadors. This is a no-brainer. Engaged alums can help you innovate, and they will be your most loyal fans. IBM has a million former employees running around who can help that company beta test, productize, do things. I mean, this is like money. And of course, having an influential alumni network in the future, I believe, is going to be important to get you on this list, any of these lists. Boomerangs also make great rehires. 66% of them go on to become star performers versus the open marketplace. And you can always re-engage the ones that got away. This is Deloitte Impact Day. This is the glue that keeps people coming back. They remember the great experiences that they had with their former friends and colleagues. And you'll never know who they might know that they can bring into your organization. Loyal alumni will help you grow your company. Ernst & Young, in 1 year, got 9% of its revenue directly from alumni. That's incredible. So how do you do it? You've got multiple tech options. You could do a private branded experience. There's two companies that are big in the marketplace, like Minds and Conenza. You can also start DIY, and you've got lots of options relative to LinkedIn, Facebook, Meetup, and I'll be happy to take questions specific to this later on. But the point here is get going, because they're going to connect without you. Worst case scenario is an employee alumni network starts that you didn't get to be the glue, and that's going to be bad for your business. So be that glue. At my company, we live by this principle. I started the Hired Guns 12 years ago to pull together the best of the digital creative class, and it's paid off. In 12 years, 50% of my, right now, 50% of my revenue comes from referrals from my talent. The other 50% comes from talent that's gone on to become clients. And I've never had to make a cold call since I started running my company. But don't just believe me. I went out and talked to a number of alumni directors from some of the top companies. Morgan Stanley, which happens to be my alumni network, I was able to hook right into them. They live by this. And Leslie Bradford said, you want alums to know that your company is the place that got them to where they are today. Deloitte wanted you to know that it won't get used if your culture doesn't embrace the value of its people while they're there. IBM said, you want to create a strong business case and include the benefits to all the different organizations. Just don't keep it straight in talent. It's not a talent thing. It's a biz dev. It's a sales and marketing challenge. And McKinsey wants you to know that it starts and ends with your organization's values. Ask yourself, and this is a great time to ask your CEOs and the different senior management in your organization, are you true to your value set? Because it only works if your company values relationships. So we have the technology. Use it to unlock incredible value. Build that star factory by managing the entire life cycle of the employee when they're inside your organization and out. Keep those individuals in your orbit so you can go all supernova. Thanks. Book over at the convention center. I don't think there's time for questions, all right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was awesome. Thank you so much for that talk. Thank you so much for braving the rain and the pre-noon time slot this morning. I am Kyra Edeker. I am a user researcher and designer with a company called Project 202. And in a previous incarnation, I was a front-end developer. And today I'm going to be talking about empathy-building tools for better collaboration. So I'm going to start with a story. Some years ago, I was working at a startup, and I had the world's most terrible coworker. He threw temper tantrums. He actually slammed doors like an 8-year-old. He withheld information when he found that it would suit his interests. And when it came time to make a decision, he would become very loud. There was often screaming involved in meetings. And I was becoming incredibly frustrated because I felt that he was poisoning the well for the entire company and they were not going to let him go. So one day I was out doing field research, and on a break, I realized that I was not applying the same set of principles to my coworkers as I did to my research participants. So I went back to work, and I turned this guy into a research subject. I looked at him in a new way, in the way that I look at participants, in order to understand him and to empathize with him. And so you don't know it, but you have come to a workshop today. You all get to practice with me for the next 10 minutes or so about these three basic communication tools that are the basis of all user research, but they also turn out to be the basis of all collaboration. And these three tools are deep listening, non-attachment, and generosity. Very few people make technology alone. What we say and how we act has a profound impact on our co-creators. And these really soft-sounding tools are the bedrock of the collaboration. So I just want to challenge you to look at these tools in a little bit of a new light and maybe come away from this with a couple of new habits to use with your coworkers. So our first tool, deep listening. Deep listening is the basis for being present. If you are not listening, you might as well not be in the room. In research, we listen with our ears, but we also listen a lot with our eyes. We look for emotional cues, for actions, for what users are doing, but also for what they're not doing. And this informs how we design for them and what we design. So how can we do this with our colleagues? First, the basics, and I know that this is absolute speaker suicide to say this at South by Southwest. Put away the electronics. When you're working with your colleagues in a discussion or in a meeting and you pull out your phone or your laptop and you tweet or email, they instantly know that you have tuned them out, and no one likes to be tuned out. Next, the psychology researcher Jane Dutton says that many people listen as if waiting for an opportunity to make their own point. And I think most of us are guilty of this, especially when we're particularly invested in the outcome of a discussion. So practice focusing on the speaker, focusing on their opinion. Practice, and this is a trick, not thinking of a response while they're talking, but letting what they're saying really soak in. And practice asking open questions. Also, don't be afraid of silence. Silence allows people to digest what is being said. It allows them to soak it in. It allows it to kind of percolate through their brain and think up deeper and more nuanced responses. So when you hit a silent point in a meeting, just let it sit for a second. This is actually an old journalism technique for interviews, for getting more information out of interview subjects. You ask a question, they answer it, the journalist will sit silently, and the interview subject may or may not be uncomfortable, but a lot of times they offer more information. This is a technique that you can use with your coworkers. Also, remind yourself that the first task is to hear what's going on, because you can't respond well to a situation unless you understand it. So since you're in a workshop quiz time, silently to yourself, think about a time at work when somebody really listened to you, where your boss finally took time to shut the door and hear about the terrible issue that was going on. Or you were working with a developer and they finally grokked the problem that you were explaining and you figured out a way to solve it. Or you were just having an insanely crappy day and one of your coworkers sat and listened to you. The first chance you get when you go back to work after South By, give one of your colleagues this gift, just listening to them very deeply. It's incredibly profound. So you might be asking, great, that's nice, and it's going to make people feel better, but how's it going to make my product better? Researchers, including Sigal Barsad from the Wharton School and Arkan Atsalik, who they study emotion in the workplace, have found that people who are lonely or who feel that they don't have anyone to listen to them at work have lower self-esteem, they're less engaged, and they're less productive. And I don't know any teams, I know none of my teams can actually afford to have people feeling this way on them. So give it a shot. Our next tool, non-attachment. And while we are listening, we can also practice open-minded and non-attachment. What does that mean in the workplace context? Non-attachment in this context means not being attached to the outcome of a discussion or a decision that is happening. And this doesn't mean that you don't care. It means that you're not holding on really tightly to it, that you don't believe that your way is the only way, but that it is a way. It's not the best way, but it's something that can be brought to the table. And I think that this is really the hardest of these three tools to practice. But you deny yourself other options when you're attached to the way that you think things should be. And should is kind of a tricky word, and I'm kind of trying to eradicate it from my vocabulary right now. So how do we do this? Be a researcher. Make a practice of asking open questions that might disprove your theory or lead you in a new direction. So with my old coworker, when we started to butt heads, which was extremely common pretty much every day, several times, I started peppering him with questions. And the longer I peppered him with questions, kind of the calmer he got. And the calmer he got, the more clear he was able to make his idea. His ideas for how things could go forward actually gained clarity. Because his ideas gained clarity, our team was actually able to appreciate them better and begin to work them into the product more, so it wasn't this sort of bullying situation that we'd been experiencing. It really became the start of true collaboration. So how do we let go of attachment? Reframe. So before you go into a discussion or into a room, look at where you are really invested in the outcome. And this can be especially hard to do when you are upset. So the first step there is to acknowledge that you're upset, because that way you can be okay, kind of tweaked out about this, I'm going to take a breath and try to reframe and be able to really hear other people's positions on this. In research, we're taught to observe dispassionately, but we're also taught to observe where our users are being pressured. And you can do this with your coworkers. Are they being pressured on time, with their deadlines, with budgets, with their boss breathing down their neck? Is it something not even at work at all? It's their family, or something's going on with their kids. All of these things can help you kind of release your grip on how you think something should turn out in this discussion or this decision making. So workshop time, again. Think about a time at your work where somebody budged, where they gave up something that they really wanted, or they made a compromise on something they were holding on really tightly to, and how that allowed your team to move forward. You can give this gift to your coworkers. So studies have shown that openness to colleagues' ideas creates trust, which enables new ideas to percolate up. And new and innovative approaches are nearly impossible without this open-minded incubation space. I want to stress, though, that non-attachment is not about rolling over. It's not about only accepting other people's ideas and never pushing your own forward, because that doesn't really help anyone if you're just submissive all the time at work. It's to make space, to make a safe space for everyone's ideas to get a fair hearing, so that you can integrate the best parts of them and have a more robust product. And now we come to our third tool, which is the most fun tool to practice. I'm a big fan of generosity. As a user researcher, it comes with the territory to be generous to users, to advocate for them, and to strive to make their lives better. And because we've listened to them, and because we've sat with them with an open mind and not judged how they're doing, our first two tools, we empathize with them, and we bring them back within us to our team so that we can advocate for them. Every design and decision comes out of this generosity to users. Like, how does this help the user? How else can it ease their pain? So this can be applied to teammates. If you were designing a work environment, wouldn't you want to advocate for the employees that are working in it? You are designing a work environment every single day with your actions. So there's a number that you should know. It's called the Lozada line. And if you were in Jane McGonigal's talk yesterday, she actually touched on it briefly. It's 2.9103. But what it really is basically a 3-to-1 ratio. Coworkers, colleagues, teams need essentially 3 positive interactions or comments to every 1 negative interaction or comment in order to function well. This has been tested in a lot of different workplaces. People come in and they rate the interactions, and the people who are rating low on positive comments perform poorly. They have terrible team. People are dropping out like flies. Teammates are unhappy. And when the managers consciously make an effort to increase positive interactions, their workplace is transformed. Because it's a quirk of the human mind to remember negative things more than positive ones. So you have a chance to tip this ratio every single day with your actions. Losada line, and it's from a psychologist researcher named Marcial Losada. So how do you give this gift to colleagues? You can enter discussions literally saying to yourself, how can I go into this meeting or this talk and do one generous thing for my coworker? How can I help you accomplish this? As a designer, how can I adjust this design so that you as a developer can develop it in the time frame that you have? As a project manager, what can I give you to accomplish this task? And volunteer your time and advice. You are all brilliant, amazing people who have so much to give to your coworkers. See it as a service. Volunteering doesn't just happen outside of work. It can happen inside of work also. And it doesn't have to be work. Give yourself and your coworkers the gift of play, of games, of brainstorming. It can be fun. So a last quick story. These tools are not about giving away power, but about creating an environment that strengthens the hands of all collaborators. And the tough coworker that I had, I started consistently finding things that he was doing right and telling him about it. And this was great because on one hand, it made me look for things that he was doing right and made me like him more. And on the other hand, it made him feel great because someone was seeing what he was doing right in the workplace. And it really brought a huge transformation about in our relationship. So much so that a product that he had essentially vetoed, he's the system architect, a few months before, he started working with us to find a way to develop it. We eventually did develop it. It became the most successful product in the company before they were acquired. So they sound really like soft little easy tools that anybody can be doing, but they can completely change how things are done and if things are done at all. So take these tools that are not about giving away power, but creating an environment for collaboration, and make what was once impossible built. You can think of them as social hacking, with generosity and empathy at the root of change. But in reality, your team is a community, whether you want it to be or not, and whether you chose them or not. So you can make it a supportive and functional and collaborative community with these tools: listening, non-attachment, and generosity. Thanks for your time. Stay dry.
Awesome. So can you hear me well? I'm not going to speak from the podium because I prefer to speak from here. Thank you very much for coming this morning. I kind of saw the rain this morning and, you know, the Hilton, sorry, the Hyatt is far and everything. So I'm really excited to see everyone here. My name is, I'm the founder and CEO of HealthTap, which is an interactive health network with more than 10,000 physicians that will answer any health question that you have for free in minutes. And I want to dedicate this talk to my team. And if you look around and see some people with scrubs saying, "I heart my doc," this is my amazing team that made everything possible of what we've achieved to date. I'm also an avid TEDster, and I've been part of the TED community for quite a bit. And beyond being part of it, I also run TEDx Silicon Valley and curate it. You know, about a year ago, the folks from TED gave me an opportunity to give a talk at TED. And I chose the second thing that I'm very passionate about, which is smiling, which is a topic that I did research on, I wrote about. So I gave this talk, and it was fun to do, and the TED folks posted it online and somehow went viral and was, a few million people watched it, and it was embedded a few tens of thousands of times. But most importantly, It got to a lot of people, and then the TED folks came back to me and said, hey, why don't you write a book about smiling? And I said, I don't have time to write a book. I need to run a company. And I said, no. And then they said, maybe you do want to write it. It's a short book. It's just an e-book. Go ahead and do it. I went ahead and did it, again, with a lot of help from people in my team, and end up doing this book that taught me a lot about how important smiling is, not only for me and my team, but for everyone else. So I want to share with you something about smiling and take some of these learning to show you how you can create a great company based on three P's that I will share with you in a second. So I started my research with a 30-year longitudinal study from UC Berkeley, where the researchers looked into a yearbook and looked at the smiles of the subject in the yearbook. By measuring the smiles of the subject, the researchers were able to predict how fulfilling and long-lasting was the subject's marriage will be, again, after 30 years, how inspiring she would be to others, and how well she would score on standardized tests of well-being. And this is over 30 years of a study. An even more amazing study from Wayne State University, published in 2010, looked into a baseball card of major league players, of pre-1950 major league players. By measuring the span of a player's smile, the researchers were able to predict the span of his life. Players who didn't smile in their cards lived an average of 72.9 years, whereas players with beaming smile lived an average of almost 80 years. Another interesting study from Germany looked into activity in the frontal lobe of the brain when we smile. The frontal lobe is very important because it's the reward mechanism of the brain. When we do something that is very rewarding for us, the frontal lobe has a lot of activity in it. So what the researchers did is basically injected Botox to suppress smiling muscles while showing pictures to people before and after they did this action. They were actually surprised to discover that after they injected Botox, the activity in the frontal lobe was actually diminished, which means that an act of smiling itself actually gives us pleasure. And smiling is a very well-known pleasure inducer. So think about chocolate, another well-known pleasure inducer. So researchers in the UK discover that one smile can generate the same level of brain stimulation of up to 2,000 bars of chocolate. Think about it again. The researchers were able to equate the brain stimulation of one smile to getting up to 16,000 pounds sterling in cash. That's like 25 grand a smile. It's not too bad. And unlike chocolate, smiling is actually healthy for you. Smiling helps reduce the level of stress-enhancing hormones, like adrenaline and dopamine, and increases the level of mood-enhancing hormones, like endorphin, and reduces overall blood pressure. So smiling is really, really good for you. What's more interesting that came up from my research is that smiling is not only good for you, it's great for people around you, because smiling is evolutionary contagious. And this is a study from Uppsala University in Sweden, but also Penn State University, found that it's very difficult to frown when looking at someone who smiles. And why is that so important? Because when we smile, we make everyone around us smile, because it's evolutionary. So you can not only make yourself feel better and feel great when you smile, but you actually make people around you do that. And this is part of another interesting study that shows why smiling is evolutionary contagious, that I speak about in my book and the talk, and I encourage you to do it. I'll try to be conscious of time. And go to the next thing, which is, okay, if smiling is so great for us, and when we smile, we feel good, we look great, but also people mimic our smiles, which means that they start looking good and feeling great when they look at us, we have a great feedback loop here that we can employ in our companies. And this is something that is very, very powerful. So we decided to employ some of these things at HealthUp, which is the company that I'm running in Palo Alto, and make it part of our culture. But smiling alone is not enough. What I wanted to talk with you about today is how to build an infrastructure, a meaningful infrastructure that will keep people motivated and happy as you're building a revolutionary, groundbreaking startup that will change the world. So before we even started writing the first line of code in a repository, or even the first sketch on a napkin, we spent about 2 weeks with this company writing a vision and credo. You say, why spend time writing a vision and credo? This is something that maybe big companies do way down the road. And, you know, go ahead and build some stuff. But from building other companies before and being lucky enough to make them successful, I learned how important it is to align people around a set of values. So the first value there is passion and positive energies, but you see that there are a bunch of values that we live by day in the company. And this is not just a document that sits in a plaque on the wall or in a website, and it is on the website, healthtap.com/vision and credo, but it's also something that we bring again and again in team meetings. Every week, we choose one of the values, and we talk about them. And every retreat that we have, twice or three times a year, we open the entire vision and credo to the company to suggest new values and to improve it. And you see the second to last value there, sense of adventure, was actually added by three employees in the company about 2 months ago when they believed that it's missing in our vision and credo. They brought it up, they got energy into the company, and they said, we want to add it. We had a vote, and we added it to the vision and credo. I want to highlight three of the P's that I believe make a very successful company that are very important building blocks in our vision and credo. And the first one is positivity. How many people here are entrepreneurs? Starting, building companies? Awesome. It's really easy to start a company, right? It's like especially at the beginning. You just start there and, you know, and then 2 years after you go public, right? It's very easy. So starting companies is tough, right? Everything at the beginning is not working the way you want it to work. Most of the time, people, when you ask for something or you want to do something, they will tell you no. When you try to do something, you don't have enough resources, you don't have enough people, people don't know you yet. Things are tough, and you're more likely to hear no than yes. But if you're positive, and if you think positive, it actually makes it much easier for you to endure this thing and actually have fun while building your startup. So let's put positivity in action and choose the first value, which is passion and positive energy. And we put both of them together because they're very important. We value passion and positive energy. We believe that the world is changed by passionate people who channel positive energy towards a vision they believe in. So this is extremely powerful. And why is it powerful? Because it helps us overcome challenges. It creates optimism in the company. Because when you're positive and things are going hard, you don't care about it because you know it's going to be great at the end. You just need to continue doing what you're doing. And the last thing that is very important, it allows you to dream big. Because when you know that eventually things will happen and will go well, the positivity helps you go forward and enjoy what you're doing. So positive energy fuels our progress and brings joy to our journey by helping us endure, see beyond, and overcome challenges and difficulties, which are very ubiquitous to a startup, and this is another part of our vision and credo. The second thing is purpose. So when I was a little kid, I read a book that I really loved, Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne. How many people read the book? Awesome. It really inspired me that I always dreamed that I want to travel around the world one day. I took more than 80 days. I took 8.5 months, a backpack and a credit card, and went traveling around the world to volunteer and to learn what the world really is and understand how successful people build this amazing world, and see it in different cultures. I write about it in my book, and I encourage you to read it, but one of the most important things that I learned in my journey around the world was that people that build amazing things always had one thing in common. It was purpose. They had a real purpose in place that they could articulate very well. They could answer the question, why? And that's really important. So building a company around this and understanding what is the value proposition that inspires you to do what you're doing is extremely important. So one of the values in our vision and credo reads, we value health and well-being. We're on a mission to create a healthier world, one person at a time. And look at the second part of the sentence. And we recognize that this starts at home. We pledge to take care of our own health and well-being and to help others do the same. It needs to be authentic. You cannot preach to others to be healthy and then create a company at home that is not living by these values. So when you come and see the snacks at HealthTap, you will see that they're healthy snacks. You will see fruit every day in the company. We live by what we preach, and that's extremely important. Why is that important? Because it's very good in attracting amazing talent. Look around, see in the back, we have amazing people here. Physicians who left very secure jobs to come and work with us. We have PhDs from Stanford in bioinformatics. We have amazing, amazing people that came to work with us because amazing people want to have purpose. They don't just want to have a job. It motivates well beyond business, and it's fun to do something that you really believe in. And it builds accountability. We want to help a billion people all over the world improve their health and well-being. See, I said it. A billion people all over the world. Now I need to be accountable to what I said. People want a meaningful job, but also customers. Customers want to buy and use product of companies that they can be aligned with. And partners want to work with companies that believe in things that they believe in. The last piece that I want to share with you is priorities. Because it doesn't matter if you have a strong purpose and you're very positive, if you don't align your priority right, especially in a startup, you're not going to get to where you want to get. And the king of Bhutan, just before he gave his reign to his people, came up with this whole notion of gross happiness product instead of gross national product. And if you think that it's only this small country of Bhutan, I was invited to China to give a talk at the World Convention of Operation Smile, and I met a bunch of people that told me that in China now, they're starting in many provinces measuring beyond GDP, which was the biggest driver of happiness in China, GHP, because GHP is something that becomes very meaningful when people go beyond the initial necessity and growth and then start thinking about what's beyond money, what's beyond growth. But in order to do, why is priority, why are priorities important? Because even in China, before they went and dealt with GHP, they also dealt with GDP, making sure that people come out of poverty and be able to live a dignified life. But they did it one thing at a time, right? And priorities help you optimize resources, improve focus, and also increase efficiency because you know, if you started a company, that you always have fewer resources than what you really need. So a value that I want to emphasize on this one is something that helps us prioritize, which is a strong emphasis that we have on HealthUp in data and analysis. And why is that important? Let me read for you the value for a second. We value facts, data, and analysis. Whenever possible, we use facts, data, and information as the language of our internal discussion and as the basis for our decision. When a strong opinion and fact are in opposition, burden of proof will rest on the opinion. And so very important to measure, very important to use data and analytics to understand when to put the priorities. But the reason I chose this value to show you is not only because data and analytics are really important, but because the last part of this sentence, the burden of proof will rest on the opinion, was changed by people in the team. It read differently when we wrote it at the very beginning. It actually read, when strong opinion and fact are in opposition, the fact will always win. And people in the team came up in one of the retreats and said, hold on one minute. What if there's something to do with ethics? What if there's something to do with other extraneous factors that are not just in the numbers? Do we need to take that into account? And we paused for a second and talked about it and changed it because we realized that it's very important to use data and analytics to prioritize and decide what to do first. But it's even more important to make sure that we're ethical and we're considering other circumstances beyond just the numbers. So that came from the team. And this is the bonus P that I will give you, which is the fourth P, which summarizes this talk, which at the end of the day, right, if you have positivity, purpose, and priority, at the end of the day, what matters more than anything else is the people. Because the people are the ones that own these values. The people are the ones that create them and live by them. And if they believe that they created it, and they believe that they have a right to shape them whenever they want, they will actually live by them. So every Friday in the team meeting, we actually bring these values up and discuss them. Every retreat, we enable people to basically come and question them or change them. But at the end of the day, we actually own this vision and credo, and we live by it to create a very successful company. So if you want, again, the HealthUp folks are with scrubs in the back. If you want to talk with them about what we're doing, we're definitely hiring. And it was a pleasure to talk with you all, guys. Thank you very much.
this on? Yeah? All right, okay. All right, guys, thank you for showing up in this early hour on a Saturday of South by Southwest. Was a bit late for me last night, too, so I'm going to keep it a bit quiet. Can everybody hear me, right?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. My name is Joris Verbocht, as you can see on the plate. And I'm going to talk to you about a little story and an adventure I had last year. It's called Traveling Band Road Trip to Happiness. So I want to go back to January 2011. Like most people, I always make like New Year's resolutions and try to come up with a good plan for the year. So in 2011, I thought, well, why don't I just learn a new thing every month? Just learn a new programming language, teach myself some new design skills, stuff like that. So I set off to learn 12 new things in 2011. But then, about a week later, I got a call from this girl. And this is, it's not what you think it is, at least that's what I told my wife. But this girl's name is Matanya Joy Bradley, and she's the singer of a band called Bradley Circus. So she calls me, excuse me, and she says, we're in a bit of a problem because our bass player left, and as I'm a bass player and she knows me, she said, well, can you fill in? I said, yeah, that's okay, I mean, why not? And when is it? She says, it's next Saturday. I'm like, okay, so let's rehearse. And okay, we did a rehearsal and then we did the show, 3-hour show, awesome show. And so I had lots of fun, and then, okay, they dropped me off at home and I'm like, okay, that was fun. And then the next day, she calls me again. She says, you're in. I'm like, I'm what? She says, just say yes. I'm like, say yes to what? She says, well, we've decided that you're the new bass player of the band. And even better, next month, you better take a month off because we're going on tour to the U.S. Like, you know, being from the Netherlands, I'm like, oh, this is my dream come true. I'm going on a tour with the band in the United States. I'm like, wow. So we did the tour, really successful tour. This year we did the tour again, a month. I just came back last week. We did record a new album, so that was like living the dream, right? This kind of, you know, I'm like, okay, so what am I going to do with this? Because I'm not only the bass player in Bradley Circus, I'm also a chief developer at a company called Mangrove, which is an internet agency in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. So I thought to myself, how can I use this experience in my job as a developer? So I want to take a look at three things. First of all, I want to look at the team. You know, in a band, you know, this is the team, right? And it's not a regular team. I mean, it's kind of special because you're not only working together, but, I mean, you're always on the road, in a van, you know, with six people driving to God knows where, to different venues. You never know where you're going to play, places like this. You cannot escape. You cannot say, well, now it's time to go home because there's no home. I mean, you're in a tour, you're in the band, you're in the van, you're on the road. You cannot escape. And, I mean, things happen on the road. I mean, you get a blowout. I mean, this is going to take you a couple of hours, and you have to be there in time in Florida, and you forgot that there's another time zone there, so you're an hour late, and then you have to rush, and you get pulled over by cops, and you get speeding tickets. Stuff like that happens. And you cannot escape. You cannot just, I don't know, I don't like this anymore. Mommy, I want to go home. It's not possible. So you're stuck. And then you need a place to sleep. You know, people's houses, or you end up in places like this. You never know. And it turns out that there's some real bonding going on there in the band. So it's a close team, you know. And it's even worse because the thing really happens on stage, right? And this is the place you really cannot escape because there's people watching you, listening to the music. And, you know, things go wrong on stage. I mean, I don't know, is there any musicians in the audience? Right, so you know, things go wrong on stage. I mean, the guitar player, you know, a string breaks, or he forgets, he plays the wrong chords, or a drummer misses a break, or the singer forgets some lyrics, or, and you have to adapt, right? You're on stage in a band. You cannot say, oh, she made a mistake. Oh, stop, stop, everybody stop. She made a mistake, she made a mistake. You can't do that. There's no finger pointing. And the thing is, think of it, if you're in a team, you know, building websites as we do, or, you know, whatever product you're building, we tend to, you know, if mistakes are made, we tend to, you know, point to other people. You know, this is a stupid developer, or the designer made a stupid design, or the management is not okay, or how could sales ever sell this product? I mean, there's finger pointing going on. And I think you shouldn't do this. If you're in a team, everything you do is a team effort. So if there's problems, you have to solve it as a team, right? Fix problems as a team. Don't finger point, don't try and, you know, get out of it and like, oh, it's not my problem. Think of it as a band. You're on stage, you cannot get off. You have to fix it right there as a team. Second part, there's an analogy here. Well, let's say the product, right? So for a band, I mean, this is the product, right? You're on stage, you're playing music. This is easy. I mean, if you're an artist, you know your product comes from the heart. You know, this is what you do, right? So many people think that artists are like, you know, magicians that just know how to paint, they just know how to make music. But, I mean, we all know as artists, that's not true. I mean, you have to own your craft, right? You have to practice, you have to learn how to play guitar, you have to learn how to sing, you have to learn how to paint. It actually takes you a lot of time to be a good musician and be a good artist. The same in your daytime job. I mean, I got this from Saul Guy. I mean, the thing is, do you want to be credible or do you want to be incredible?
Right.
So, and I think you should try and be incredible all the time in everything you do, be it as a musician, as a web developer, as a manager, as, you know, a sales guy, whatever you do, especially if you're creating stuff, you should be incredible. And the way to do this is, you know, get better and get even better every day, right? Just put the energy in it and do it. And you should practice, you know. And this is, I like this picture. I put this picture in 2 days ago, and I was looking at the picture and I was like, who's the student and who's the teacher, right? Because this little guy, he taught me a lot of stuff. I mean, I was there. There was a couple of kids in New Orleans in the lower Ninth Ward, and we're doing music lessons with them. And this guy's like, yeah, I want to play this instrument. I want to play this. Never played double bass. I want to play this instrument. And then, oh, I want to play the guitar. Oh, I want to play the drums. And turned out he's a really musical guy. He can sing. He came up with lyrics. They invented a new song. And I was like, so actually you can learn from, you know, little kids. Their enthusiasm gives me so much energy. So I was thinking of, am I the student or am I the teacher for this kid? Part three. It's what I call the audience, right? If you're a band, I mean, this is the audience, right? Can be the audience. And come to think of it, if you run a business, I mean, you would never call this your clients, right? If you're on stage and in a band, you will never call these are my clients. Well, though they're funny guys. But if you're building a product, if you're running a company, come to think of your clients, it's kind of your audience, right? And it's not only your clients that are your audience. I mean, this can be your coworker, right? Who's not in your team, who is in your team. They will look at your work. They will see what you're doing. They will get inspired by the stuff you do. Or it can even be an ex-employee, like we saw in a previous talk. I mean, they can still be inspired by what you do, even if they don't work for your company anymore. Or it can even be your boss. That's not my boss, by the way. But, I mean, your boss can be your audience. I mean, he can be a fan of the stuff you do, right? Or even your competitor. I mean, why not? So the thing is, everything you do, be it as a musician or be it as, you know, a developer or a sales guy or whatever, everything you create can impact other people's lives. It will impact other people's lives, and it can change other people's lives. So again, there's a picture, a shot for the kids we did in New Orleans. I mean, the things we do can change their lives. I mean, those kids are, I don't know if you know the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, but this is the area that got devastated by Katrina, by the flooding after Katrina. And these kids are basically living, you know, it's a hopeless situation. But by telling them that you can be a musician, you can come from over Europe, fly over to the U.S., do a tour, and get there and play music with the kids. And they were like, yeah. So now it's a mindset, you know. They got in their mind that you can be successful as a musician. For example, if you're good at making music, why not just do it? So you can change people's lives. And the thing is, last year when we were on tour, we met so many amazing people that were like inspired by the music we made, that if you inspire people, they give back, right? You give something to people, they give back. They want to help you. They see you are struggling. They see you have no money. They see you're on tour. You're away, far away from home. They let you into their homes. They feed you. And the best is you can get into situations like this. They tell you, come into our studio and make a record. It's yours. Just go into the studio. We made an album this year with a Grammy Award-winning producer. I mean, he did this basically for free because he liked the music and he likes the band. I mean, stuff like this happens. If you give to people, they give back. They will come back to you. Same thing if you work for clients. I mean, if you regard them as the people you give something to, the audience, your fans, regard your clients as your fans. I mean, they will help you. They will come back. They will give you something that you need whenever you need it. So I want to conclude. If you give your passion, if you give your vibe, if you give your energy every day in everything you do, you're going to live your dream and magical stuff will happen. I mean, this is one of my favorite mottos. It's nil volentibus ardum, it's Latin. It means nothing is impossible for the willing. Right. Thank you, guys.
This is going to be really awesome, I promise. Awesome. Oh, that's for the internet connection. Yeah, totally. Definitely. Okay, so now we want to see if this thing works. Not just yet. Yeah. We're going to find out. And that's the hope. Okay, this is rad. Well, we're not connected to Ethernet, so.
That's mine.
Okay.
Yeah, all of the.
All the stuff.
Yeah, I can keep it under that.
I can plug it into it every, like, up here, in case, or not.
Wow, that did nothing. Oh, okay. There we go. Okay, so when I go full, my hope is that. Where do I, how do I? Yeah, please. Thank you. I'm just going to, I can move the computer just close to me. I'll just scroll through the left and right on it. That's fine. You know what I'm going to do is just keep it close, and I'm just going to go left. I'm just going to use the arrow key. That's fine. Thanks. Okay. Thanks for not leaving. My name is Jordan Burchett, and I'm an internet dinosaur. I've written email using DOS. I've performed research on Metacrawler. I've exported video to RealPlayer. I have a Yahoo email account. Not Hotmail, though. I'm not an animal. My editorial stops have included ESPN.com, Maxim.com, CNN.com, all places where I came to believe that every article, pictorial, and blog post meant the difference between life and death for a kitten or starving child somewhere in the world. But after over a decade of 18-hour work days and repetitive stress injuries, I had come to alienate friends and family, neglect my health, and physically threaten a BizDev guy during work hours, not kidding. And for what? For all the love and blood and monthly urine you give a company, it never loves you back. But we're all looking for something to believe in, so I devoted myself, entirely too much of myself, to a company that didn't deserve it. Like a 12-year-old's pubescent boner, I was abused to no end than to make billionaires billionarier. But then I got the best news of my adult life. I was being laid off. Now, I must admit, I originally intended to make this presentation a parody of the book Eat, Pray, Love, in which a rich white woman complains about her privileged life, travels for a year making zoo animals of the world's peoples on her publisher's dime, and then eventually makes millions telling other white women about it. But I couldn't read more than 20 pages of it, and even that took me 4 days. So what I'm simply hoping to do today is impart to you what I learned about online content creation during the time when I did at least. I thought for sure that, driven mad by idling, I'd be back to work within weeks. After 3 months, I hadn't checked a single job listing. I read comic books. I caught up on movies. I enjoyed my first consecutive night's sleep over 6 hours in years. Of course, this lifestyle was incredibly unprofitable. Despite a site launch in Hong Kong of several months, I'd become a living, breathing austerity measure. I was a New York City resident who in 2010 made $28,000, two-thirds of which came from unemployment benefits. I walked everywhere, unable to afford the subway. And that's when I could afford to leave my apartment at all, which is something I didn't do in some cases for up to 72 hours at a time. But my joblessness paid handsomely in perspective, allowing me to transition from technological vanguard to curmudgeonly old man. Like Sam Worthington sympathizing with the Na'vi, I had the training of a producer, but now the naive desire of the consumer to read something written in earnest. Because some consumers don't know how the internet really works. As we all know, the web's a beast that must be constantly fed, regardless of the quality of the grist, a series of understaffed sites furiously scrambling to maintain a post count designed to provide maximum buckets in which to carry ad inventory, and hoping to God that of all the shit thrown against the wall, something sticks in the form of a Google News or BuzzFeed spike. My experience in Hong Kong taught me that when the Chinese need to increase productivity, they don't concoct an innovative plan for maximizing efficiency. They just shovel more human coal into the fires of commie capitalism. Much the same way websites today throw more Drupal pages full of words into the aggregation turbine. And it's hard to blame them. If you got a nickel every time you opened up a document in Microsoft Word, you would spend all day, every day, pressing Control N. That's what most websites are doing today. Now, coming up here and simply bemoaning the direction which things have headed would make me a Luddite. But that doesn't mean I have to embrace everything about that direction. The internet is not a girlfriend. I don't have to love everything about it. So how did we get here? Like many of you, I came of professional age during the infancy of the internet, which gave jobs in media to people like me who weren't otherwise qualified to write on a bathroom wall. But the web pulled a bait and switch on us. It seduced us with the promise of a venerated career, journalism, publishing, and whatnot. But once it got us, it let itself go, becoming fat, short-sighted, and financially unrewarding. Like an abusive husband, this once handsome, munificent medium now batters the writers on whom it depends with $20 blog posts about Kardashian and top 1,000 lists at $100 a pop. But others of us came of actual age during the rise of the web, explaining much of the fluff and narcissism currently plaguing it. We're now reliant for our information on an entire generation of producers raised on disposable blogs, paste-up sites, and glorified message board threads. While the web has made better writers of average people through email and social media and what have you, it's actually made worse writers of the people paid to do it. Articles that draw 100,000 views today wouldn't have been accepted by a campus zine 20 years ago. But it's not entirely the tweener dipshit's fault. In 1912, hell, in 1992, the job of a writer was to produce the best material for his editor. It was then the editor's job to package that content for consumption. In 2012, a content producer's job isn't to produce the best content. It's to convince the most people to click on that content. In 2012, a writer on the internet is little more than a click salesman. Who cares what happens when the reader gets there? It's like going to a live show headlined by Charlie Sheen. I already got your money, dude. This may be no more a revelation than the moral of a romantic comedy. But it's something conspicuously scarce in this year's schedule of presentations. There's all kinds of stuff about content strategy, packaging, and delivery. But what about the content itself? The quality of material online has declined right along with the compensation for it. Who's to blame? Well, for starters, I am. I'm going to crap freely on the state of the internet. I have to take some measure of responsibility for it. It's been a consumer medium for roughly 16 years. I've been working within it for roughly 13, so I'm sorry. But you're probably all to blame, too. If you're an editor, you probably don't demand enough of your writers. If you're a writer, you probably don't demand enough of yourself, which would eventually warrant demanding greater compensation from your editors. Anyone here seen The Wire? Anyone? Television show? Okay, great. Then you know what I mean when I say that you have to decide whether or not you want to be real police. Back in high school, our football coach told the gathered team that we were all there for likely one of three reasons. One, to be seen wearing the jersey in school on game day. Two, to satisfy somebody else's expectations of us. Or three, to know what it's like to work toward a shared goal. Now, I've seen plenty of jersey wearers make careers out of content, but these aren't the ones who change hearts and minds. To be real police takes personal sacrifice. You have to dispense with the, they're only paying me this much, they're only going to get this much effort mindset. Because as with the staff at McDonald's or Best Buy or Walmart, consumers will eventually settle on a shitty level of service from the content they consume unless we demand more of ourselves. I've had writers during my experience as an editor whose haste I appreciated when the timing demanded it. But these weren't the people I turned to when a truly special project came up. Taking seriously whatever work I've been assigned as a freelance writer, be it a rinky-dink blog post or a six-page magazine feature, has made me that person to other editors who feel so guilty for paying me so little for what they get in return that they often, more often, think of me when they have bigger budget features. Being paid less than you think you're worth is not an excuse to dog it. And I see it often. Users have been burned far too often by the glut of machined content currently plaguing the internet. Realizing their time is more valuable, they're saving their content consumption for the media that matters. And if I sound like I'm fighting windmills here, consider Salon.com, which is deliberately publishing one-third fewer links than it did a year ago, but is enjoying 40% more traffic. Instead of slapping its logo atop the same stories its competitors are all racing to regurgitate, Salon has dedicated its resources to breaking its own news for those competitors to chase. There's a similar story emerging at TheAtlantic.com, which is investing in less frequent but more thoughtful updates and has seen its uniques effectively double over the last year. Or BuzzFeed, for that matter, which recently committed itself to original content, having hired over a dozen reporters to break unaggregated news. Its founder's stated intent, quote, making content people are proud to share. Imagine that. Most content isn't made with pride, let alone shared that way. This commitment to real content is better for your brand, plus it's the best way to gird yourself against the next change in Google's algorithm. Now, the churn and burn, more is more approach to content creation isn't going anywhere, any more than are the shady financial instruments that contributed to the economic collapse, which is fitting, since they were both developed to game their respective systems by warping their initial reasons for being in order to reap exponential profits. Anywho, that's how it looked from my couch. Short of exhorting you all to quit your jobs, here's what I propose. Be more precious. Countless thought leaders in the industry have advocated less preciousness, less persnickety attention to every word, brushstroke, or half note, and to an extent they're right. But you have to earn a caveat like that by having been precious at all to begin with. And most internet copy is written with all the thought of a lunch order at Applebee's. Next, try a little sincerity. Now, I'm not advocating the death of irony, and snark is the official language of the internet, even for people who suck at it. But there's a written equivalent of looking the reader in the eye, lowering the wall between producer and consumer, brand and user, that is what community development is all about. You've now seen the kind of people who comprise our industry, so there's no use writing as if we think we're cool, because we're not. Next, push back against the forces of evil, principally your ad and marketing departments. I've watched countless editors cave spinelessly to the vagaries of account managers, but it's not the ad guy's fault. He's doing his job by hooking a content sponsor. Surrendering to his often admittedly lame feature idea disadvantages every involved party. The client, the ad rep, and the poor schmucks who have to write and edit this advertorial abortion. Nihilism has too strong a grip on our side of the business, encouraging editors to acquiesce in hopelessness to the money guys who put us in these situations. Sack up and push back. They don't want to have to settle on the 10 oldest spices brought to you by Old Spice any more than you do, but they will if you don't give them something better. Finally, It's not about you. Everything from Yelp reviews to political commentary is more about the person writing it than the subject being discussed or its value to the reader. Once you're done writing 200 introductory words about what an influence Whitney Houston was on your life, select all, delete, then make with the toxicology report already, because you're boring. The reader clicked to learn about a dead diva, not a diary entry. Now, if it isn't patently obvious, I was asked to speak here just 3 weeks ago, when someone else dropped out. That means that probably one guy, or girl, on the South by Southwest selection committee really liked my original pitch but got shot down by the others. 3 months later, one of them likely asked him, or her, "What was that submission you liked so much? We just got an opening." I'm doing this presentation for that guy, or girl. If there's one reader out there, even just one reader who might really be into what you're doing, write it for them. And that's that. Thank you. And you're all free to go home, I think, now.